committed to bring peace and security to the war-ravaged country via negotiations and urged the Taliban to pay heed to the demands of people and approve a ceasefire. This is why a sharp increase in violence has shocked the entire nation and even prompted the UN body in Afghanistan to react. This comes as media workers, political activists and government employees have turned into the most frequent targets for assassination, mainly over the past 2 months. According to Afghanistan's Interior Ministry, over 50 individuals, all of them media workers, political activists and civilian employees of government, were killed and over 70 others were wounded over the past 2 months. So far, regional and international players like Iran, Pakistan, as well as the UN, have pledged commitment to help Afghans in different fields such as peace and democracy.
Governments also have a positive obligation to take all necessary measures to ensure the protection of everyone against violence, threats, retaliation, discrimination, pressure, or other arbitrary action that is taken against them as a consequence of his or her exercise of human rights. There should be no space for impunity.
The calls for collective efforts to bring peace to Afghanistan comes as the intra-Afghan talks are set to be resumed on January 5. So far, the Taliban has not yet approved a ceasefire. Now, many in Afghanistan hope the new round of talks could pave the way for peace in Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The floating Safa Reservoir north of the port of Hodeidah, which carries a million barrels of crude oil, poses a great environmental risk since it has not been put under any maintenance since the beginning of the war on Yemen. Recently, an agreement was reached between Sana'a and the United Nations to maintain the reservoir. Sana'a has already signed the agreement, while the UN is still stalling until today.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs facilitated the entry of technical experts for the maintenance of the safer tank, as it was agreed upon in July. But we were surprised by the United Nations postponement of the operation to February next year, and we do not know about the reasons. We hope the United Nations will expedite the dispatch of maintenance teams for the safer tank, because if a leak occurred, it would constitute a major disaster.
The Supreme Economic Committee confirms that the United Nations has not yet signed the agreement and surprised everyone by delaying the arrival of experts until February 15th, which could cause a disaster because the water had already entered the engine of the tanker, threatening it to sink or explode.
The United Nations is using the safer oil vessel as a pretext to impose political and economic pressure on the government of Sana'a. The Saudi-led coalition, on the other hand, has also used the tanker to implement its own agenda, despite greater dangers that also threatening the Suez Canal.
The delay of the maintenance operation, as well as the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi coalition, has led to an oil derivative crisis from which Yemenis have been suffering for months. This has also reflected negatively the health sector.
Experts confirm that the sinking of the reservoir will cause an environmental catastrophe from which Yemen will not recover for more than 30 years until it gets rid of the dire consequences of contamination. The crisis will also cause the extinction of millions of marine life from the Red Sea. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a, Yemen.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking point that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition. The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. It will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Since its independence in November 1948, Lebanon, the small Arab country, has been the scene of a myriad of conflicts, challenges, and political bickering. The year 2020 was not unlike any other year, but even more challenging. As the country was engulfed in the economic, financial, and monetary crisis, another challenge hit the global scene in the form of a novel coronavirus. The first few positive cases of COVID-19 in Lebanon forced the country, like the rest of the world, into a lockdown. This lockdown was preceded by an unseen monetary crisis where the Lebanese lira plummeted against the U.S. dollar. U.S. sanctions on Lebanon led banks to limit cash withdrawals, and queues were seen daily facing banks. Observers look at the year 2020 as being one of the darkest periods in Lebanon's history.
We've lost everything, literally. You know, we've lost the companies, we've lost the banks, we've lost the economical system, we've lost the political system. There's nothing left. And you know, when you have nothing left, the only thing left is humans and their potentials.
The overall system of governance in Lebanon is seen as something that needs to end. Waking up to a new crisis had become a norm until the Beirut port blast. A large amount of ammonium nitrate exploded. The explosion ripped through the port of Beirut, killing over 200 people and wounding over 6,500, destroying large parts of the city. With a multifaceted crisis in the Mediterranean country, the explosion in the Beirut port in August of 2020 only served as an additional, unprecedented blow and a national tragedy for all Lebanese. However, politicians and the media remained intensely at odds.
We're used to, you know, Israeli attacks. We're used to having a little bit of, you know, security incidents on the ground, but we have never been used to something so huge. As huge as it is, I guess it was great for uniting the Lebanese over, you know, a cause. This time and during the blast, we didn't find part of the Lebanese being happy for, you know, blasting another part of Lebanon. It was like, you know, general for all sects, for all people. And I guess it was a turning point because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that at this point we really need to rethink the political system in Lebanon. It was the first time he ever said that publicly on air.
Following the blast, Prime Minister Hassanna Diab was forced to step down in respect for the victims. Investigations into the blast are still pending. Same goes for talks on forming a new government. Although the majority of Lebanese factions agreed to name Saad Hariri as prime minister, it seems the year 2020 will end and the formation of a new government remains in limbo. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Palestinian Refugees Committee in the Gaza Strip organized a rally against the UN AIDS and Health Services reduction. Palestinian refugees who have impacted badly by this reduction participated in the demonstration, calling for the world body's attention to the dire condition in the impoverished enclave.
It's our right to get the UN's aid services. People here are living in a deteriorating condition amid the pandemic. People here can't afford living, and now, with the reduction of the UN aid services, their life is getting even worse.
Palestinians believe the reduction in aid services by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, is an attempt by the U.S. to liquidate the humanitarian organization. Earlier, the U.S. announced plans to withhold $65 million of aid to the UNRWA until further notice.
The UN aid services reduction will have dire consequences as it deprives the Palestinian refugees from their basic rights. The reduction comes amid a critical political time as Israel is stepping up its pressure on the Palestinians.
By reducing the refugees' aid, the UN is standing beside the Israeli occupation at the expense of Palestinians' rights. We are calling for our rights, and the UN should fulfill its commitments.
The demonstrators call on the international community to reverse the reduction decision by the UN and keep on supporting the Palestinian refugees who have lost their lands and were expelled since 1948.
The reduction policy aims at reducing the aid services step by step until Palestinians are completely deprived of their rights. The UNRWA was established to help and support Palestinian refugees. The reduction policies serve Israel's interests.
UNRWA was established to aid the 700,000 Palestinians who were expelled from their homes during the war surrounding Israeli occupation's establishment in 1948.
More than the half of the 2 million people in the Gaza Strip are dependent on support from UNRWA, and depriving them from the services they need will worsen the living conditions. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The Knesset, the Israeli parliament, dissolved itself and the unity cabinet collapsed, pushing the Israelis into yet another early election on 23rd of March. That would be the fourth in 2 years. The Knesset dispersed after failing to meet the legal deadline for approving a budget for 2020. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of the conservative Likud party had refused to present a budget in violation of his coalition agreement with his main rival turned partner Benny Gantz of the centrist Blue and White party.
The dissolving of the Knesset was simply because of Netanyahu's unwillingness to give up the premiership. The very possible scenario is the return of another political impasse for Israel. So Netanyahu will not be able to form a coalition that's satisfying and acceptable for all parties. We may even witness a fifth election after the upcoming vote.
Experts, however, say the dissolving of the Knesset would have been more advantageous for Netanyahu. It's not only a deep distrust between Netanyahu and Gantz. Netanyahu was gambling on another election in the hope of forming a right-wing religious cabinet that would grant him some kind of immunity from prosecution. Netanyahu's corruption trial is scheduled to move into an intensive evidentiary stage in early 2021, requiring his regular presence in court. The current cabinet will remain in place in a caretaker capacity until after the election, and the formation of a new cabinet is a process that could take many months. However, the Israelis are convinced that there isn't any guarantee that the fourth election would finally end Israel's internal dogged stalemate. According to observers, Netanyahu has triggered early elections in an attempt to stay in power beyond his current term. However, they add that Netanyahu's fight for re-election is a difficult battle, mainly as his corruption trial is scheduled to resume with witness testimony next February. Mona Kandib, Occupy, Ramallah.
Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali about the master of the martyrs, Sayyid al-Shuhada, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Stay tuned.
محرم مجالسش در پیشه. این مجالس با چنگ و دندون نگه داشته شده به ما رسیده.
We have the morning ceremonies or majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam ahead of us. We inherited these ceremonies with many difficulties, and holding these majalis during history was not very easy. We were not taught to be a Shia in a classroom. We learned to be a Shia during the months of Muharram. Therefore, the majalis for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam are very important. Even you could find great ulama and scholars during the history of Islam who were individually fond of holding morning sessions and ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Karbala. As I step onto your sand, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed beneath your skies.
این که می‌بینید بعضی از بزرگان ما، خدا رحمت کنه مرحوم آیت الله هاشم آیت حسین اصفهانی، معروف به کمپانی.
One of such scholars was the great Shaykh Muhammad Hussein Qaravi Isfahani, known as Kompani, who had great respect for the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. His love for Imam al-Hussein and the majalis on his martyrdom was to an extent that he himself kept the shoes of the guests and distributed glasses of tea among them. Now we see that even the great scholars of Islam spends their time and energy to hold morning ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the months of Muharram.
Karbala, why do you hold such memories? Ashura, always full of mysteries. Ashura.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
Are beginning, the season's tears are flowing. Our iman, we are condoling. Our new year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning, the season's tears are flowing. Our imam, we are condoling. Karbala, what precious blood was spilled there? Ashura, Al-Hussein was murdered.
Join us in this journey.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yemen is currently the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Yemeni people are facing a long list of unbearable problems such as daily airstrikes, famine-like conditions, different deadly diseases, and an economy in tatters. Meanwhile, Yemeni children are undoubtedly the most vulnerable part of the population. The situation of children in Yemen has been described as a crisis within a broader humanitarian catastrophe. This week, Yemen's health minister once again raised the alarm about the situation of children in his country. Taha al-Mutawakkili said 3,800 children have been killed in attacks carried out by the Saudis and their allies over the past years. He also warned that the aggressors' bombardment campaign has devastated Yemen's health infrastructure, making it increasingly difficult to save children. The plight of the Yemeni kids has once again come under the spotlight, just a few months before the 6th anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led military offensive against Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Children's Fund said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from a preventable disease, 2 million are out of school, and thousands have been killed or maimed since 2015. The United Nations has been quite loud in voicing concern about the ongoing crisis, but it is also under fire for removing the Saudi-led coalition this year from a blacklist of child killers. The Saudi-led alliance was first blacklisted several years ago for killing and injuring children in a war.
The United Nations, of course, has this very typical, very endemic weakness, I dare say, being that it's an organization that for a big part is dependent on the world superpowers to really take action. And we have seen in the past that for this reason, it is very difficult sometimes for the United Nations to really come into action, even when a lot of the member states might want to. We have enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia.
It was on March 25th, 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the United Arab Emirates, began pounding Yemen from air, sea, and ground. Now, another anniversary of the beginning of the offensive is drawing close with no end in sight to the campaign. Why is this war dragging on so long, and why is the international community failing to put an end to it? The invaders launched a bloody offensive in the hope of achieving a quick victory. However, to this day, none of the stated goals of the military campaign have been met, with the Saudi-led onslaught being described as a fiasco. But the invaders are not changing course. They have indiscriminately bombarded civilian areas. Markets, funerals, weddings, jails, medical and water supply facilities have all been hit. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Western countries, particularly the United States and Britain, have refused to review their ties with Saudi Arabia over the bloodshed in Yemen. They have instead intensified their backing of Al Saud. The United States and Britain have stepped up their arms sales to the regime despite the human suffering in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States has provided the Saudi and Emirati forces with different types of military assistance. Critics insist the heavy U.S. military support has made America a partner to the devastating war. Observers believe without Western diplomatic and military support, the UNSTAB would have ended a very long time ago.
The sworn enemy of the Iran nuclear deal will be leaving office very soon. The U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in May 2018, left no stones unturned to completely destroy the JCPOA. Trump managed to significantly undermine the hard-earned international deal, but he failed to achieve his ultimate goal of killing the deal. Now, just weeks before Trump becomes a former U.S. president, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal renewed their commitment this week to preserve it. The foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom agreed on Monday that no party should set fresh preconditions on a revival of the JCPOA. Their statement is believed to be paving the way for Washington and Tehran to come back into full compliance when Joe Biden takes office in January. Trump tried to destroy the deal by imposing tough sanctions and scaring off other countries from doing business with Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back some of its JCPOA commitments. The next U.S. president will need to remove Trump's favorite sanctions against Iran, and Tehran, in return, will be expected to put back in place certain limitations on its nuclear program based on the JCPOA.
But if they return to the nuclear deal and into full compliance in action, Tehran will do the same by returning practically into full compliance. What is important here is that return by the U.S. or some other parties to the nuclear deal into compliance, if it happens, theoretically, that will not suffice. What they need to do is that they return practically and in action.
The U.S. president-elect has pledged to restore the JCPOA when he takes office. Will America take this opportunity to rejoin international diplomacy and multilateralism? The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has repeatedly said that American sanctions deprived Iran of the benefits that his country is entitled to under the nuclear deal. Iran's top diplomat says the Europeans share the blame of the irreparable economic harm to Iranians. On Monday, Zarif took to Twitter after the meeting with his counterparts from China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK. He posted a chart showing how trade between Iran and the EU has gone down over the past years, despite repeated European promises of better economic ties under the JCPOA. Zarif warned that this is a last chance for the Europeans to save the deal. The top diplomat said that Tehran will quickly reverse the measures that it took in response to the U.S. withdrawal and European breaches if they perform their duties well. Iranians are undoubtedly infuriated by the West's failure or unwillingness to properly implement the deal. Recently, Iran's parliament passed a piece of legislation that would prevent UN inspections of Iranian nuclear sites if sanctions are not eased within 2 weeks after Biden takes office. The new law would also require the administration to enrich uranium to the 20% level using advanced centrifuges. Some senior European diplomats, like the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, said that Iran should not further dilute its nuclear commitments. Some observers believe, however, that instead of lecturing Iran, the EU should immediately focus on how it can properly fulfill its own commitments.
I think the one side that can have demands is Iran, because after the withdrawal of the United States from the nuclear deal, that was Tehran who remained in the deal. Iran showed strategic patience for a year, and after that 1 year, Iran's reduction of commitments happened under the terms of the nuclear deal. So they have done the violation, and the Europeans were despite their words and promises, were unable to compensate the U.S. withdrawal and exit from the nuclear deal.
Time is fast running out. Iran's top diplomat insists that no democratic country should expect the government to violate the deadline set by the recently approved parliamentary legislation.
It seems that the incumbent U.S. President Donald Trump is keen to leave his mark on the presidency by pardoning some of the most horrific state crimes, with yet more anger raised by his most recent action. In his latest moment of absolution, Trump has officially given a pardon to the private security mercenaries from the so-called Blackwater security firm, a U.S. company shrouded in controversy and shame over crimes committed by its personnel in Iraq. During the incident in Iraq in 2007, four Blackwater security personnel opened fire, threw grenades, and used high-caliber weapons against a crowd of Iraqi civilians, killing 14 innocent, unarmed people, two of which were children. Following an investigation by parties including the FBI, the four guilty Blackwater murderers were sentenced to jail terms ranging from 30 years to life, something that many believe was too lenient, yet others thought were too harsh.
أتمنى من المحكمة الأمريكية بعد ما توصلت إلى هذا القرار قرار الإدانة أن تصدر قرارها بإعدام الجنات لأن هناك ما يقارب 20 عراقي أو 19 عراقي راحوا ضحية.
In spite of the crimes committed by the four men, many people in the U.S. fought to seek a pardon for them long prior to Trump announcing the plan, with the lawyer representing the criminals, Brian Heberlig, suggesting that the four did not deserve to spend 1 minute in prison for their crimes. One can only then question the rationale behind the reasoning of both Trump and the lawyer of the four murderers, especially when it comes to allowing such acts to happen, only for the powers that be allow for the criminals to get away with a crime and the ending of 14 innocent lives. There's a famous song that states that you can get by with a little help from your friends. And it seems that this is very much the case for the friends and partners of Donald Trump. Already Trump has pardoned some highly questionable figures in recent times, with many of them coming from the military or private sector background that enjoy close links to the president. Most recently, Trump has also pardoned Paul Manafort, Roger Stone and Charles Kushner, all close contacts and all sentenced for corruption and lies.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for giving me the offer. Thank you for saving my life, because I don't think at my age and in my medical condition I would have survived in a COVID-infested prison. The president has said on numerous occasions that he thought there was a good chance I could be exonerated. I agree with that.
But it's Trump's links to Blackwater that raises questions, with Eric Prince, the founder of the company, not only being a close ally of Trump, but has also acted as an official representative of the president in the past, something that clearly shows that there's a link between the pardon and the two close friends. Yet the pardon also comes as no surprise, as in reality, the victims of the terrible crimes committed have all been in US-occupied lands, suggesting that Trump is continuing his discriminatory policy against non-white people, something that Trump has certainly become renowned for over the years. But for Trump, there's no doubt that his famous motto of Make America Great Again has failed. And after 4 years in the White House and his seemingly effortless ability to divide the nation at home and create tension abroad, Trump's true lasting legacy will be MARA, or in its full form, Make America Racist Again. The one impact that Trump has been able to deliver on, it seems. The United States has spent the last two decades fighting an endless and unwinnable war in Afghanistan, with the conflict costing the US billions each year, as well as a loss of life on both sides, reminding us all of the embarrassing defeat suffered by the US in Vietnam. But with the US slowly outstaying its welcome in West and Central Asia, as demonstrated by the Iraqi parliament voting to oust them, it seems that Washington is intent on leaving a lasting legacy in the region, particularly in Afghanistan. A secret CIA-trained hit squad known as Zero One has been trained in Afghanistan, with evidence suggesting that the group, who operated under the cover of darkness, are responsible for a series of extrajudicial killings and executions across the country, and most worryingly of all, against civilians. Reports from numerous eyewitnesses and survivors suggest that as many as 51 innocent civilians have been killed, with the youngest amongst them being only 8 years old, as the terror group targets schools, medical centers, and other various institutions. With the raids apparently taking place across 4 districts in Afghanistan, and with most of the victims having no links to the Taliban, the question arises as to whether there's some kind of partnership between the CIA-trained operatives and the Taliban. According to multiple reports, the US has broken multiple rules of war, breached human rights, and has failed to deliver on any of the promises it made when it comes to building a secure Afghanistan. This raises the question as to just how the US can genuinely justify their presence in the country with so many operational failures in place.
The problem here, we're talking about the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and what we call in this country collateral damage, is that there is no justification at this point after 18 years. We invaded Afghanistan allegedly to go after the Osama bin Laden, who it turns out was problematic in Pakistan. There was no way the Afghanistani government could accede to the demands that President Bush made when he made them in 2001. And, the justification is just not there. Now, after 18 years...
With attacks such as those completed by the 01 unit, one official from the Afghan intelligence agency has stated that Americans have always been present during the 01 raids. But the official failed to distinguish between the blurred lines as to whether the unit were special forces, task forces, or quite simply, CIA agents. What's clear is that the US has a very shadowy modus operandi, and this is something that seems to allow them to get away with the murder of civilians in the process. With pressure mounting on the US to leave Afghanistan and Iraq, could training such groups by the CIA and US forces guarantee a proxy unit for the US military in the area once they've left? We know from the past that the CIA has a long history of interfering in various sovereign states, and in particular are keen to arm certain groups to the teeth in order to either justify their presence in an area or quite simply allow splinter groups to carry out the dirty work on behalf of Washington and Langley. In fact, when one looks into the money involved in performing such tasks, the figures are quite boggling, with the CIA allocating some $2.5 billion of their budget to covert operations alone, a sum that equates to around 5% of the total intelligence purse. But when some of the groups backed by the CIA are actually fighting back against the US, including killing its military personnel in the area, does this not create a notion of double jeopardy for the US, showing just how desperate they are when it comes to maintaining a foothold in places such as Afghanistan?
It's a question of desperation. The Trump administration met with the Taliban about a year ago or 2 years ago, as far as we can tell, and basically said, if you stop killing Americans, then we can get out of here, basically. We don't care who else you're killing, but don't kill us. And we can work something out, but if you're killing us and killing our troops, then we're never going to be able to withdraw from here, because we're not going to withdraw under fire. That's basically the United States position.
There may be many similar cases around the world that have yet to come to light. This report, however, has finally exposed the CIA as the main funding party behind the execution of civilians. What remains to be seen is whether such groups will remain US proxies in the future and continue to allow the US to carry out a series of illegal operations, all whilst being able to deny being present at the time.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I thought Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to continue, and I'm back now again, and I do wish to try to finish off sharing some important points that is valuable for all of us to learn about here in this book. Now, if you go back to the first session, the intention that Sheikh Jawadi Amuli had in compiling this book was for the sake of it being a complementary to the famous dua book Mafatih al-Jinan, and that's why he wrote it with the same kind of sequence of title, that being Mafatih al-Jinan, the keys to heavens, and this is the keys to life, Mafatih al-Hayat, the keys of life, the keys to how to live. It's very much Quran and Hadith based, and maybe inshallah there would be somebody out there who has the ability to translate this book into English language inshallah, and then of course it would be of more use for everybody else. Now the last discussion that we had was on the importance of seeking knowledge, the etiquette of طالب العلم, a seeker of knowledge, and some of the things that we need to keep in mind as far as how we are able to acquire knowledge. Yes, there is the level of devotion that a person needs to have, but there's also the issue of you seeking knowledge as an incumbent obligation upon your shoulders, where you really put as much effort into trying to gain knowledge and useful knowledge. And you need those tools as well. You need to know, of course, how you are able to memorize information, how you are able to gather information, what are the sources and references, and all of the other things that we discussed. Here we're continuing on, and in this chapter we're speaking about the importance of working, how a person finds the ability to gain determination and endurance, perseverance, to be able to continue on with getting somewhere in life, having goals and ambitions. That's, of course, something very, very important. And, you know, we regularly come across the hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, Al-kada ala iyalihi, Al-Mujahid fi sabilillah, that someone who struggles for the sake of gaining an income for his family, or obtaining livelihood for his family, al-kad ala iyalih, for their family, Al-Mujahid is equal to a mujahid on the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that's what that is also what jihad is. So a form of jihad is jihad in for the sake of gaining halal means for your family. How are you able to do that? Of course, through work. You have to be able to have that level of importance and understand that importance in order for you to be able to continue on and carry on with your work.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
That's why the Holy Quran, in the Holy Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "وَأَنْ لَيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى," that a human being has nothing other than for them to carry on or continue on or struggle and endure. So when we look about this subject and we look into why is it that Islam says to us that you need to work, you need to struggle, you need to endure difficulty in order for you to be able to gain an income. But the important point here is for you to be able to gain a halal income. And that's why in all of the discussions that we will be sharing, the most important thing here is you being able to get somewhere in life, for you to have ambition, for you to endure, for you to have that level of determination and resolution, or what we call himmah. But also for, at the same time, for you to keep in mind that it's never going to be at the cost of you, for example, going down the wrong path of non-halal means. And this is exactly why Imam Ali alayhi salam, in a beautiful hadith, he says that a person who does persevere, a person who does have that level of determination, of himmah to work and to endure the difficulties of work, you know, that sweat and that hardship and that pain, physical pain or mental pain, is not probably not only equal to ibadah, but maybe even better than ibadah. You know, and let me read what Imam Ali, salamullahi alayhi, says in this regard. He says, "Al-ibadatu sab'una juz'an." Ibadah, worship, is divided into 70 parts. Afdaluha talabul halal. And the best form of these ibadahs is the seeking of halal, a halal income. Of course, which means that it's related to working, it's related to you moving yourself and you getting up and out and everything else. You know, and it's always, you know, equaled to kal mujahid fi sabilillah afdal or al ibadah and all these other kind of hadiths. We'll continue on with chapter number 4 in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alamin wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart
there will always be there, be there.
These days, we do most of our communication via social media. It comes in handy, especially during the time of coronavirus. But it isn't safe for everyone. This is why many young girls are quitting social media. According to a new global survey by the rights group Plan International, nearly 60% of all female users of online platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, have experienced harassment. This is what is driving young girls from across the world to get away from social media. In the US, 3 times as many girls reporting being harassed online or by text message than boys, according to the National Center for Education Statistics.
It's terrifying. As a mother of a young girl, I try to instill in her the importance of other things besides the way she looks. And I think if we as adults and as a society talk to our young girls about the importance of their mind and other extracurricular activities and other things besides the way they look, maybe we can make some difference. Maybe we can make a change. Maybe they won't feel as much pressure to judge one another.
According to Tamara, girls are not being put down by strangers online, but people they know.
Now it's not just, oh, the people in my school or the people in my class. It's thousands of people that go on social media and can see this one girl's post about this other girl. And can you imagine how much trauma that would cause that one girl knowing, you know, one of my peers just said this thing about me and it's true or it's not true, but it's out there for the world to see, and how devastating that would be for that young girl.
According to the study by Plan International, 1 in 5 girls has abandoned or cut down her use of a social media platform after being targeted. Attacks were most common on US-based media platforms. Here are the statistics. Facebook, 39% of girls polled said they had been harassed, followed by Instagram, 23%, WhatsApp, 14%, Snapchat, 10%, Twitter, 9%, and TikTok, 6%. The survey polled 14,000 girls and young women aged 15 to 25 in 22 countries, including Brazil, India, Nigeria, Spain, Thailand, and the United States. Not too long ago in Australia, a child model took her life due to online abuse.
Thank you to everybody for the overwhelming love and support that the family has received over the last few days. We realise many people have travelled a long way to be with us today, and we appreciate everyone who came along today to say farewell to our beautiful daughter and our beautiful little sister Dolly.
In Germany, 2/3 of the children have smartphones by the age of 11, making it a hub for cyberbullying, especially the abuse of little girls. For years, international entities have tried to rein in the social media apps, almost all of them being large American conglomerates profiteering off of anything on their platforms. According to the British counseling group Safety Net, social networks' failure to tackle cyberbullying is risking the mental health of young people. The other problem is that kids aren't talking. Safety Net reports that two-thirds of British social media users said they would not tell their parents if they experienced something upsetting online. This prompted Duke of Cambridge Prince William to take a stance all on his own in this regard.
For me, the issue of cyberbullying and its consequences are personal. My work as a HEMS pilot, air ambulance pilot, has exposed me to the tragedy of suicide and the despair felt by those who've been subjected to cruelty and abuse. Through my work on mental health, I've spent time getting to know parents and children for whom the impact of online bullying has been devastating. And as a parent myself, I understand the sense of loss and anger of those particular families who have lost children after they were the targets of campaigns of harassment. I feel a responsibility to do what I can to help.
But more must be done. The United Nations says that leaders, public figures, and parents must all do more to protect children. Every year on November 20th, the United Nations holds an annual event for World Children Day. November 20th is an important date for the UN, as it is the date in 1959 when the UN General Assembly adopted the Declaration of the Rights of the Child. It is also the date in 1989 when the UN General Assembly adopted the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Last year's event, the specific topic of social media abuse, was touched upon in detail.
I'm convinced that social media doesn't have to be a place of fear, bullying, and harassment. It can bring people together. It can be a place of love and support. Somewhere in the world right now, a teenage girl is being bullied online. She's scared, she's vulnerable, she feels alone. My message to her is this: you are not alone. There are people who care about you, and there are people who will listen if you reach out for help.
No one at that specific event blamed the large conglomerates for the child abuse on their platforms. Simply put, companies are not using profits to protect children. Even the Vatican took note of this, and the Pope called on social media companies to take action. That was back in 2017, and according to Plan International, nothing has changed. Shortly after Plan International published its 2020 survey, Facebook and Instagram said they used artificial intelligence to look for bullying content, constantly monitored users' reports of abuse, and always removed rape threats. Twitter said it also used technology to catch abusive content and has launched tools to improve users' control over their conversations. These methods have proven to have failed, as these platforms might be unknowingly encouraging abuse. Those behind the abuse are getting away with their behavior, according to the survey. For now, it seems that as young girls are catching on to the inaction of huge businesses to protect them, they are just shunning social media. This marks a new trend in an environment where social media and digital communication is being promoted for convenience and, of course, because of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. It shows that girls have simply had enough, and if world leaders and businesses aren't taking the necessary action, then they certainly will.
IRIB English Radio.